Hello there, this is Kevin Pascal and you're tuned in to the Hinted Neuron podcast. On this episode, you hear me talk with Ene Ijatu. She's a feminist, youth advocate, a writer, and also a stylist. We talked about feminism, gender, and equality. At some point, you would notice that we kept digressing towards philosophy, but that's the beauty of engaging in this dance of nuance to conversation. Personally, I think she's a brilliant and amazing human being. I also see myself having other conversations with her in the future. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or share this episode. If you have any questions, comments or concerns, please reach out on Instagram or Twitter at Hinted Neuron. And now, here's my conversation with Ene Ijatu. I'm here with Ene Ijatu. Thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
One of the main focus of this discussion is to highlight some of the current trends around the issues of gender, feminism, and equality, since there's now much in our social discourse. And it's now beginning to get hard to have much of these discussions around, a very sane manner whereby we could have discussions around this topic without resorting to people insulting each other. That was one aspect. And, why I wanted to have you on this podcast, because I've seen your views and your debates with other people on Twitter too. It's very important for us to have these discussions in a very nuanced manner, in a way we don't result into talking over each other, because that's what happens mostly on Twitter and those other platforms. So I guess a good place to start would be, talk about the history of what feminism is and, the different waves it has evolved through and, where we are now in that movement.
Well, that question actually would require me to define feminism then, because you're saying what it is and how it started. The inception of feminism is the definition of feminism. So I don't think they can be removed from each other. But yeah, feminism generally, I would describe political, cultural, and economic movements that aimed to establish some sense of equal rights and protection for women, legal protection for women specifically. And over decades, women have fought for the right to bodily autonomy and integrity, the right to own property, reproductive rights, contraception, prenatal care, protection from gender-based violence, domestic violence, workplace rights, etc. And I think feminism was born out of the need to establish that full human rights of women as human beings in society. So when people talk about feminism and talk about feminist history, I think it can categorically be put into three waves. That's the first, second, and the third wave of feminism. And I think, obviously, the first wave was the beginning of feminism. And it started around the 20th century. Yeah, where women, it was basically about women trying to vote. It was like women were saying men have always had the right to vote. Being able to vote means a person is a full citizen and full human being that is recognized by law. So women should have that right to vote. And the second wave, which was around the 1960s, 1970s, was about women's liberation movement for equal legal and social rights. That's the right to own property and etc. And the third wave, that's beginning in the 1990s, refers to the continuation of and the reaction basically of second wave feminism. And first wave feminism actually, aside the fact that it was basically concerned about women's right to vote, it was also about contract and property rights for women, and the basically the autonomy of women, as in the liberation of women from being seen legally as properties of their husbands. And primarily, it was right to vote, then this, that's the right to autonomy as an individual recognized under the law. And yeah, the first wave feminist movements, obviously, in America, was, I think it ended with the First Amendment. Yeah, the first the passage of the First Amendment. Sorry, the 19th Amendment, sorry, to the United States Constitution, and which granted women the rights to vote. And yeah, second wave of feminism, like I said, focused on equality and discrimination. And it talked a lot about women's cultural and political inequalities as inextricably linked to the personal lives of women and your personal identity and stories in society as we see it. So, and it was a lot of the time focused on the most amplified voices of the secondary feminist movements, which were always white, cisgendered women in America, and which in the third wave of feminism, which we currently are in, has sort of removed itself from that narrative because it felt like that narrative was exclusionary in a lot of ways because it didn't have an intersectional view of what of the experiences that women go through and the experiences that women face in the world, because it was just basically women like Germaine, yeah, and other white feminist icons who were at the forefront of the movement, and their stories were always centered around their own personal experiences. So it didn't encompass the experiences of, say, a Black trans woman in America or other marginalized and minority groups in the country. So that's how third wave feminism was born, as a response to that particular narrative of second wave feminism. So yeah, I think basically that's just, we are at this stage where feminism is trying to encompass all the intersectionalities involved in achieving women's full human rights. So it will take the viewpoint of a Muslim woman, the viewpoint of a woman from other religious backgrounds, a woman who is Black, Hispanic, Asian, and so many other different diverse groups of women, and unite their challenges and their struggles into one. And that is why I think a lot of the time, third wave feminism, that's the feminism that we currently have, is synonymous with intersectional feminism. So yeah, I think that's where we're at.
That's really interesting. It's a really good brief. But I think intersectionality is one thing we would have to go. I think that's something we'll still talk about in this conversation. But you said something at the beginning. Do you think, like, you know, I don't know how you view feminism. Feminism as an idea, as or a political movement. That's just a quick question. So that would just, how do we have to view feminism? Because I don't know how to ask this question, or I don't know if you get what I'm saying. Feminism as an idea or feminism as a political movement, are they the same thing?
Well, the thing is, I feel I've had this conversation with a lot of people before, and I say that feminism is fundamentally the ideology behind women's rights and liberation on the basis that all genders are equal and deserve equal rights. But the movement of feminism, and I think some feminists, some people who identify as feminists, just like I am one of those people who identify as feminists, who disagree with me on this, is that I think the movement is removed from the ideology in the sense that the movement is the interpretation of individuals in approach to actualize this this ideology of feminism. For example, say radical feminists are intentionally anti-traditional structures that have been put in place to keep women in certain roles, and men also. I mean, though the focus is not on men, but like generally the anti-traditional roles. And so they would always go against traditional roles just to make the statement that women should be liberated from those confining constructs of traditional gender roles. But then someone like, say, what other kind of feminist? Then we have liberal feminists, we have neoliberal feminists, we have, these are people who, feminism as a fundamental ideology is women's rights on the basis of equality of all the sexes. Now, the approach is the the various movements that surround feminism. Say someone is taking a radical approach to feminism. Someone is taking a liberal approach to feminism. Someone is taking different. I think that's the difference between the ideology feminism and the movement feminism.
Yeah, that's a whole lot, because I mean, feminism has evolved into this big thing where there are just so many kind of points and school of thoughts on what it could be, and so many ideologies.
That's the problem, because I think it's hard for people to separate feminism, the ideology, and feminism, the movement, because the movements are like the face, should I use that word, or like what people see when they, or like someone who's approaching feminism from a purely on academic or on intellectual point of view would assess feminism based on its representations that self-proclaimed feminists portray. So, for example, someone who is coming from that point of view that is not intellectual or non-academic would see feminism as a radical feminist feminism. Or someone would see the entire ideology of feminism, as the point of view of like a liberal feminist or an intersectional feminist or et cetera. That's the problem.
What do you think? Because let's just like center on you now for a bit. What do you think were your own personal experiences that drew you to feminism? And like, why, or maybe the simple question is, why did you become a feminist?
When I think about the various things that led me to feminism, I think for me, it has always been that when I talk to my parents, I've always been that child who was always questioning things. I really wanted to understand the mechanism of why thoughts were the way that they were, why beliefs are the way that they were. And I was just open to questioning things. And one of the things that I questioned a lot was the traditional portrayal of who I was supposed to be, what I was supposed to wear, how I was supposed to behave. Oh, sit down, close your leg, you're a girl. Or girls don't climb trees, or girls don't do this. And I've always wondered, why was my entire being forced to fit into like this singular box? Yeah, like why was I forced to fit into that? And for me, I didn't know what feminism was at that point in time. I just knew that I was always that strong-headed child who would always give her parents headache because she never really agreed to wearing the clothes that her mom wanted her to wear, or sitting the way her parents wanted her to sit, or going to the kitchen to cook, for example, because she was a girl. So there were just things I was always pushing back at, because I was like, why are my brothers not supposed to do those things? Why am I the only one who was made to do those things? And I think as I grew, I was a really voracious reader. So as I grew up, and I started reading a lot of literature, both fiction and nonfiction, I got to see like a different society. I got to see different societies. I got to see different perspectives and different views on the human society and about identity. And I think that's one of the first things that I think the first feminist that I ever read about was Simone de Beauvoir, the person who wrote The Second Sex. I think I stumbled upon her book in a library. That is like the bizarre, it was a very bizarre thing. I was in secondary school. I think I was in JS 2. Our school library is very extensive because it's like funded by the university. I was in secondary school, so it was really broad. So I stumbled upon the book, and I didn't make sense of a lot of things then because the language was kind of complex. But I think from the things that I was able to pick up, I picked up the definition of feminism and woman and the various factors that come into play in how women are represented in society. And I think for me, that's my first true intellectual introduction to feminism. So since then, it has been various other authors that have caught my fancy and that I've indulged in reading and conversation. Yes.
I think your secondary school must have been very rich, because Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex to be found in a Nigerian library.
I know, right?
Kind of odd.
That's one of the weirdest things. And when I tell people that story, they're like, for real, for real. And I don't know. I feel compelled to go back to that school and just go and see if that book is still in the library so that I can take a picture and be like, what the hell? But yeah.
I think, especially in Nigeria, most people got to know about feminism just by reading Adichie's work.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
That was the most popular one here. So if we step back for a bit, you know, because I think most of the third wave feminism is happening online. I think because most of what, that's what I think. Because, you know, most of what people, the most of the advocacy and the talks and the discourse around feminism right now is happening online. But I don't know if you agree with that. But I think it has now sparked this whole... So it has, I think, because there's a lot of talks about this. There's even something I heard about a fourth wave feminism, that one is what's happening on Twitter. Well, I think since this discourse is happening mostly online, it has packed up this whole gender wars and, you know, feminist hating men and talking, and we're always seeing these issues every day. So I want you to comment on what are your thoughts on this gender wars and, you know, where it would go during the course of so many years from now.
To be honest, I have like a lot of criticism for gender wars, to be honest, because I think both the men and women, yeah, who perpetuate and who feel this gender wars are terribly misguided. I think it's not about a war against both genders, and that's the problem. And I can understand why that's a problem, because we live in such a time when genocentrism is just so popular amongst so many discourse. And I think it has to, it's because I feel personally that it's an approach that people are using, feminists are using to kind of find a way towards gender equality, because you have the argument of feminists saying, well, the point is right now it's all about women, because it's women who have been disadvantaged, it's women who have been excluded, it's women who have been oppressed. So of course we should focus on the disadvantages that women have faced and try to remedy those disparities and make it an equal distribution or a playing field. But I feel like the aspect of this conversation that a lot of people who bring forth this narrative, of course, I understand that it's women who have always been disadvantaged in this part of the conversation, because it's women who were not allowed to go to school. It was women who were not allowed to have careers. It was women who were not allowed to own property. So, of course, the disparity exists because as women have been excluded for centuries, while men have always been leading the forefront of innovation and sciences and technology. So of course there would be this wide gap, because women are still trying to close that gap that has been driven by centuries of being left behind intentionally. So, well, intentionally is a heavy word, because there are lots of factors that actually informed decisions that were taken against now seems like an intentional word also, but are taking in the disadvantage of women, at the disadvantage of women. And so, but in this decade, in this era where we have people who are bringing forth the ideology that feminism should phase out because we should adopt something more equal, like egalitarianism, that addresses injustices on a basis of what is more pressing and what is more critical to address. So they say, well, let's just leave feminism. But I think my problem with people who propose that particular ideology is that they come from the privileged perspective. And that's my criticism for them. It's the privileged perspective of saying, okay, we're in this society, we have achieved a situation where girls go to school as much as boys do. Now, yeah, women are not being excluded from a vast majority of the workforces. Yeah, there are legal laws that protect women. There are laws that, but then these are Western societies or urban societies, even in third world countries. But there are women who still have the realities of being exempted from education, who are being married off as children, who are being who have their genitals being mutilated to cause bodily harm to them and limit their bodily autonomy. And there are so many women who live these realities in millions. And so by saying, oh no, let's just like really forget that, and then let's focus on addressing the general population, that seems very privileged to me, because it is not an even field yet. Because of course I agree that there are so many issues that men go through. Of course I understand that men have to deal with mental health issues and suicides and the feeling of being sidelined when it is women who are on the focus now, women's issues that are on the focus now and on the forefront. But and sometimes it brings some kind of resentment in some men because they feel like they're being excluded and being left behind. But the problem is that we have to actually find a middle ground. Okay. And this is my criticism towards people who are generally genocentric in this particular aspect, in saying it's only women's issues that we're concerned about. I think you can be both a feminist and an egalitarian. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. And though I don't want to obviously force or compel people, and I'm not saying that you must be a feminist and an egalitarian. I'm just saying, like, you can be someone whose primary focus is rectifying the critical women's issues that are happening all around the world, because it is very critical. But you can also be someone who is compassionate and who will address issues regardless of gender and regardless of ethnicity and anything, as long as it's an injustice. For example, say I'm someone who is a feminist and is fighting for women's rights, but if there's a man here who is unjustly treated, if there's a man who is suffering from so many issues and his issues are not being spoken on, of course I would go to his, I would lend my voice to his issue, and of course I would fight for his rights, and of course that I would champion his case, however that goes. But I'm just saying that you can be both a feminist and an egalitarian. And a lot of feminists think, well, if you're focusing on women's rights, well, men's rights don't matter. I don't think so. And I think that's a very, very wrong ideology to perpetuate, because people's feelings are very important when you talk about trying to engage a large population of people to believe in, accept, and actually contribute to causes that you particularly believe in. That's the point. We cannot say, oh, well, men have to suck it up and they have to like understand that women have always been disadvantaged from time immemorial, and like it's time for them to remedy that situation. So they have to give up some of their privileges. I'm just saying that you can say, okay, men, women's issues are very pressing and we need to address these issues, but we also hear you and we also hear the problems that you are facing and we want to help as much as we can. That is not a, I mean, does that seem far-fetched? I don't know. I just, I think I can channel as much energy as I can to fight for women's causes, and I can also lend my voice as much as I can to also help men's causes. That's when I hear stories like, for example, I can't remember the name of this man who built a shelter for men in the UK, and then he was being criticized and being trolled by a lot of quote-unquote feminists, and then he committed suicide. I believe that's a very, very pernicious thing for those women who call themselves feminists to have done. Like, why would you hinder people addressing other injustices because they're not women's injustices? It makes zero sense to me. And I really don't understand the ideology that goes into that thinking of saying, well, men should die or suffer, and women's issues must be the only thing that we are addressing. That doesn't make any sense, objectively, at all.
Yeah, because I think is, you know, to frame society as this whole thing of male privilege. I mean, because, you know, we always hear this word male privilege. I've talked to a lot of people concerning this. You know, I've asked them, in your life, where do you think you are privileged? So, because it's always a problem for them to, you know, to point out maybe they could be privileged in ways they are not seeing. Of course, most privileged people don't actually see where they are privileged in. So, you know, talk to boys, you know, ask them where they are privileged, because I think that's what causes much of the pushback and anger in them, that people tell them they are privileged and they don't actually see their privilege. And, you know, that's what now causes most of this gender wars online, because you are telling me I'm privileged and I don't see the privilege, and there are laws now, they are making laws to, you know, to push up one certain gender and men feel left behind.
Yeah.
What are your own thoughts concerning that?
Yeah, and that's what I said regarding the approach that a lot of the time is being taken, for example, with quotas, saying there should be a 50-50 representation in some organizations because to foster equality in representation. So if there are 50 professors that are male, there should be 50 professors that are female, and those kinds of things. I think, yeah, for spaces such as politics and people who are responsible for constitution and legislative power, I think in those kind of spaces, yes, I do believe in quotas. I do believe in equal representation. I do believe even amongst the candidates that are chosen, there should be equal representations across gender, race, sexual orientation, ethnicity, and etc. Because only then can we have like varying perspectives and perspectives that influence laws and policies that would actually involve the experiences of people who identify with all these various identities. Yeah. So, but in spaces that have to do with merit, I think, like spaces, for example, that are academic, I think instead of saying, well, women should, whether they're merited or not, should always have a 50% space reserved, and men who are deserving, but because of the fact that they've exceeded the 50% for men, well, even though they do fare better than the women, they should not be given that space. I've had a lot of conversations with people regarding these particular issues. I don't think I can, with all good conscience, tell you that I have arrived at a stance on the matter, like a particular position where I am undoubtedly sure that it's the right thing to do. Because I do think representation is important for young people who want to go into diverse fields. And it's important for a girl, say, for example, who wants to go into the tech field, to see women just as much as men in the tech field, and a boy who wants to go to tech field also to see it as not a space that's dominated by men, but as a space that's open to cooperation between both genders. And if it were a situation whereby we had already achieved a world where accessibility to education for all the genders was equal, accessibility to information and tools and influences towards these career paths were equal, then I would say it is terrible to use that quota system. But we exist in a world currently where accessibility is not equal. There are situations where men get access to more more education than women do. There are situations whereby men are groomed from when they were younger, even in some progressive families in Nigeria, for example, where both children are groomed. They send your sons and your daughters to school. They tell them they can aspire to be anything that they want to be. But sometimes when daughters from this kind of family chooses a course that's probably male-dominated, the parents will be like, oh, well, choose this course. I mean, you can go for a course that's more men-friendly. And these are factors that influences women's choices to go for some of these career paths. And then you have the media, where when they are trying to advertise something that has to do with mechanics and cars and all this tech-based things, they use men to advertise them. So women never see themselves in those kinds of spaces. They feel if they ever go there, they would feel marginalized, and they would feel like they were always trying to keep up with something. Not everybody is as competitive and as resilient to say, oh, well, suck it up. I mean, not everybody is Marie Curie, for example, who, even though she was told not to go to school, she was told women couldn't read sciences in England, she had to travel all the way to France. I mean, she had the resources, she had the resilience, she had all that to fight against that system. Not everybody's like Marie Curie. And I know the vast majority of human beings are not like Marie Curie, I think she's the outlier in situations like this. So I do think the question regarding this is a bit more complex. And I think it's a situation that needs to be handled with more empathy than not, because I think, of course, it's reasonable to feel left out. It's reasonable to say, well, I deserve this position. Why am I not getting it? But if you step back, and I think that's the problem, I don't think you can address this particular situation only by telling men, well, suck it up and take responsibility for what your ancestors did in all these years by leaving women out. I think it's not a forthright approach to take, because I think it'd be better to appeal more to their sensibilities and their humanity in that aspect than to force them in that way to accept the situation as it is. But I think we should not lie to ourselves and say the reality of women's accessibility to tech spaces and politics are the same with men's accessibility to those spaces. And that is why a lot of the time, women who do not necessarily merit it based on the academic qualifications are given it, because it has been seen to be cases of more often than not that sometimes women who do have the merit to access the spaces might have given it up to become wives. Because let's not kid ourselves, the vast majority of women who get an education and who at the end of the day choose to follow a career almost always reduce their ambition to become wives and mothers.
Exactly.
So how do you expect them to be equal representation in those spaces or equal real competition in those spaces when we are always asking women by default to give up their ambitions to become good wives and good mothers, even if they're capable? So we can never really know the amount of women that are capable of inhabiting these spaces and making like a fairly competitive ground for this case if we are not going to take into account all these other variables that play a role in this. And I think that's where the conversation should be had. And I don't know why people are not talking about it in that particular manner. People are always just talking about, well, men should suck it up. I don't think that's a reasonable statement to make when you're having like an intelligent conversation about the reason why things are the way they are. I think it's important for us to criticize approach and find the reasons why things are the way that they are and why we're going towards the direction in the way that we're going towards it. And if it's not reasonable, then we find alternatives. Because I believe if it's not reasonable that this particular approach is being taken, then we definitely have to find another approach. It is not an infallible approach to say, okay, well, we're giving quota systems. I don't even think 100% that it's the best answer. I just think, well, for now, I don't really have as much criticism against it as I do for it. So that's
I think you are beginning to open up a Pandora's box of gender roles here. And, you know, I find it good that we'll explore that area. But I just wanted to, you know, say something concerning what you pointed out. It's just a small story from last year. There was this competition, an AI competition where, you know, people had to compete. It was over 300 people, and the organization, sponsoring and, you know, organizing this competition said that they are still going to pick girls, like 10 more girls that didn't qualify, because they had like a point you must pass. You know, they just said you will pick the first 100 people, but we'll still pick up like 20 more girls from the people that are not in that first 100, you know, and they put more girls from the other category that didn't qualify. You know, and it still didn't match up at all. The numbers were not equal. So I thought about it now. I was just thinking about it now. Do you think the problem, because just to enter the gender roles conversation, do you think the problem is interest, that we don't actually have more girls who are interested in this thing, or is just an effect of socialization and we don't have any natural explanation for it?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that girls are not inherently averse to mathematics and the sciences. I don't think it is a biological trait. I think it's a socialized system. I think women have naturally been told by the traditional gender roles that they were more given to nurturing and more given to caregiving professions and the likes. And I think men have always been told that they're more given to the ambitious and more competitive aspects of life, because we have had people who have gone against that and have succeeded. We have people who have made tremendous contributions to both aspects of these spectrums. Women who have contributed tremendously to science and technology, and men who have contributed tremendously to humanities and caregiving and other career paths stereotypically associated with femininity. So regarding that, regarding the story, actually, first of all, that you told about these girls being included, it's still the same conundrum for me, to be honest, because I'm saying I cannot objectively criticize their decision to add more girls, even if they did not qualify, given so many factors. Maybe their idea of adding girls that didn't qualify was just to say, well, we want to motivate you enough to develop interest in this particular subject, even if your interests have never really been. We want to show you what it feels like to experience this firsthand. And we want to try as much as possible to encourage you to see what it feels like, what it is to be part of this space of technology. But when it comes to a competition, like a competition based on competency, I think, and in the end, of course, it's the guys that would the guys who are more equipped that would top this particular competition, I guess. I mean, guys, I mean, both girls and boys, I mean, the people who are more who deserve it by merit, that will obviously still top the competition. I don't think it is possible. Well, it is possible, but I don't think they would intentionally mess with the outcomes of a free and fair competition. Yeah?
Yeah.
I just think probably for the qualifying to be a part of the competition was probably something that they did to just to encourage girls to be a part of it, but not necessarily to say even if you win or not win, I mean, would still make you the winner. That makes zero sense. So in this aspect, I think people who are feminists and people who are interested in gender equality should focus more on the variables that play important roles in the way girls are shaped right from their infant stage. What influences their decisions? What influences their choices? What influences what they're more driven towards? I mean, you give children toys, that influences your decision. You expose them to the media. What they see influences the decisions. I mean, when you have catalogs that are advertising, or catalogs for females that are advertising makeup and fashion, and you have catalogs for males that are advertising technology and games and sports and innovation, of course, there's going to be a disparity of outcome. Of course, there are going to be more women who are not interested in that and more men who are interested in that. And that's the point. I want to actually ask, are there as much media representation out there? Are there as much, I think I was just trying to explain that generally what people should be focused on when it comes to this equality of outcomes should be addressing all the variables that contribute to shaping women the way that, sorry, girls into the way that they become,
yeah,
and the choices that they make.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think of, I don't know if you've listened to Jordan Peterson's critique of equality of outcome. I don't know if you've...
Yeah, I mean...
Heard of the guy.
It's really
what do you
funny.
Think of his critique?
It's really funny because, like, I've heard about Jordan Peterson for, like, a while, maybe 2 years now, or more longer than that. And whenever I hear about him, it's always from the mouth of, or the perspective of a religious fundamentalist. And I'm like, if a religious fundamentalist supports this guy, I mean, how much can his credibility be? To me. I mean, to me. And I go and I Google his name, and then a clip of an argument or a conversation or a debate that he's involved in comes in, and then there's like this 5 minutes or this 4 minutes reel of what he's saying or what his stance or perspective on a particular question thrown at him is. And I think I have never really like agreed with it at all. And I'm like, wow, I really can't listen to this guy for longer than this, because I don't know how he has managed to really, but I feel like all his opponents were just less equipped than him in most of the debates that he had been in. Hold on. And then yesterday, by chance, I was just perusing through the internet, and then on YouTube, there was a suggestion. I think I was going through some philosophical threads, and then there was a suggestion to see Jordan Peterson's view on this particular issue. And then I clicked on it, and I was like, I mean, I don't know if I don't know if I was like, is this the same person that I've had this opinion about? Because it seems like the particular video that I watched was kind of contradictory to my perception that I had of him and of the other videos that I've seen. So I downloaded some of these full-length videos that probably span like 2 hours. So I downloaded, I came home, a binge watch of his conversations. And I realized that if there's anything that I can, without a doubt, accept about Jordan Peterson is his ability to be as objective as possible in explaining why his certain views about certain things are the way that they are. I do not necessarily agree with a lot of the things that he says, not a lot, or some of the things that he says, but he's a highly intelligent man and he is mostly right about a lot of things that he says. So, which is why it is so surprising that today you're talking about him and just last night I was binging on so much of his content. So, yeah, based on his belief on equality of outcome, I will say that Jordan Peterson believes that human beings inherently have this hierarchical nature that is predisposable to our, like, we're given to it by our biology, yeah? That there's always going to be hierarchy. Hierarchy is for order, yeah? And hierarchy is important to maintain order. And the systems that currently exist from hierarchy is not necessarily those that are singularly born of tyrannical people or tyrannical systems, but of more but more of competence. Yeah, competence creates hierarchy in his belief. Well, maybe you can call me an idealist, or you can call me someone who is overly optimistic about human nature. But I do believe that competency does not necessarily equate to hierarchy. I believe there can be a distribution of competence that does not necessarily rewards one person at the expense of another person who probably is not as competent as the other person. That is my critique. I'm saying just because you are this doctor who has managed to cure so many diseases and so many things does not make you more deserving of basic human necessities and rewards than, say, for example, a cleaner at a hospital who has always been diligently cleaning the hospital. I don't think you're better than that cleaner. I don't think you deserve more than that cleaner. And I probably would I probably would say this purely based on a, I don't want to use the word socialist so that I sound like someone who is standing for like this broad ideology that has been explained by different thinkers, but I'm just going to say competence is necessarily synonymous with hierarchy. I don't think it should lead to hierarchy necessarily. I think people can just be competent in their various fields, but still not be overly rewarded at the expense of other people who are not as competent in that field. And I think that's where I differ with him regarding equality of outcomes. I do think that once there is a system that is established whereby everybody has equal accessibility to things and equal accessibility to various wealth of knowledge and opportunities, I still think that regardless of how people, I feel like to Peterson, it is human nature to always want to be rewarded for the feat that you get. And I think this feat, this reward, sorry, has in his mind is always represented as a step up the hierarchy. Yeah. Yeah. But I believe that human beings can be better than that. I believe that that is not necessarily a good approach to follow by always expecting people to be rewarded, to be rewarded in sense of more importance over people because of their ability to do more. For example, the system whereby during competitions, the first position usually gets way more gifts than the other people, the other runner-ups. And people say, well, the more gifts that the first position gets motivates people to want to be the first position. I think that is fundamentally a problem because of the way in which we socialize people for competitiveness in the first place. I do understand that primitively, human beings have always seen competition as that reward at the end of that struggle, what you get at the end. But I think humans have evolved way more than we could have thought that we would. I think we have evolved past so much, so many primate givens and so many, what words they use, primitive behaviors. So I think that is one of the primitive behaviors that we can transcend. One that is more based on equality, of course, like I said, it is an idealist perspective. It is me thinking of human beings as the better of what they are, because in reality, it's very likely that very few people would actually accept this perspective of saying, regardless of how much you contribute into society, the person who doesn't contribute just as much in society should also enjoy as much as you enjoy in society. And that is how we can achieve an equitable and fair and good society where we don't reward people based on what they've contributed, but we value each individual as an important component and we encourage people to do what they feel is what they believe is right. We encourage positive behaviors, we encourage positive thoughts rather than competitive thoughts. I know people would disagree. Some people will disagree with me on this because people always say human nature, it's just the way it is and it's hard to really think. But I think if we can transcend, there are people who have thought beyond this. There are socialists who agree with this particular perspective of saying it shouldn't be a hierarchical system. It should be a system where everyone is treated fairly and equitable and nobody has dominance over another person just because they contribute more in society. And I think that's the place that I stand when it comes to equality of outcome.
Yeah, I think this conversation is going well because, you know, I want to try to uncover as much areas where we disagree so we could, you know, talk about those things. Actually, I actually had the perspective that even before I discovered Jordan Peterson that hierarchies should exist because I am more of... I like to see things from a very natural, evolutionary and game theoretic perspective. Because if you see our whole evolution, the way we evolved, it is through competition, it is through games. We've been playing this evolutionary game for long and it thrives through competition. One of my followers on Twitter, you know, wrote an article about meritocracy and she was comparing different types of meritocracy. We had a conversation about it. Hopefully I'll bring her to the podcast so we can also discuss about those things. But I still feel like, you know, the true human nature, we are not that different. At the very nature of us, we are just chimps. I don't like to see things from this whole social perspective whereby...
Of course. And I think, at the end of the day, it depends on how your view of life is then. Because for Jordan Peterson, he believes that, I'm not sure, but from his conversations, I can infer that his view on life is that the most optimal contribution a human being can give is to the advancement of the human society collectively as a whole. Yeah? But...
Mm. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but I necessarily do not believe in the human the advancement of the human society to transcend the fundamental moral obligation we have to ensure that everyone is treated fairly and equal. Because I particularly not my belief system regarding purpose and life and existentialism is not the same as his. Yeah. And I think his perspective is what has informed he believes that probably there is a purpose for human existence in the grand scheme where God wants us to achieve or attain some form of I don't necessarily believe in that. Yeah. So I don't believe that we were born to advance and sacrifice as much as we can to advance to God knows where or when. Yeah. But whomever believes that particular perspective will obviously disagree with my belief on hierarchy not being the goal. Because if you actually believe in the ultimate goal of the human experience is the collective advancement of the human society generally, then of course you would believe hierarchy is very important in this, because it has shown a long trend of it being one of the key driver in human advancement, hierarchy, competition. Yeah, you know. But for someone who doesn't believe that that is the ultimate goal of the human experience, I don't think hierarchy is necessary.
You know, at some point, you know, I've thought about this in a way whereby, because I used to hold a near nihilist kind of perspective on life. Well, I started to see things, you know, I heard this guy talking about maybe even dolphins have discovered the meaning of life for themselves. They go around swimming around every day in harmony. And we could get there as humans from, if we start to attack things from a realistic point of view, and maybe not at this whole ideologies we hold right now.
I think when it comes to meaning, meaning will always be a personal thing that is subjective when it comes to life, if we're objectively going to talk about meaning. I mean, there is no one singular, agreeable, undefeated meaning or purpose to human life or human experience. There is no scientifically proven meaning to human life or human experience. For someone who is probably logically driven in the sense of functionality and humanity as the center, or should I say, humanity is the center of the earth, yeah, as the highest form of life on the earth. Of course, they would feel this is their moral obligation to always advance the human society, yeah, to always push it towards as much height as it can possibly go. But for someone who doesn't believe in that, I don't particularly believe that's the meaning of life to me. I don't particularly believe that human beings are better than any other species just because we are the most evolved form of life. Yeah. So I don't think we have this grand purpose to find some sort of existential meaning in the entire universe for our existence. I dare say we might die trying, the entire human population. But I think that is where a lot of people's beliefs regarding hierarchy would probably differ. Because if you do believe in this, like I said, the superiority of the human experience over every other living organism on the earth, then yes, you definitely believe in hierarchy and that particular meaning in life. But if you don't, then you would agree that meaning is a personal thing, yeah? And as long as you don't infringe on any other person's right to enjoy the life that they want and enjoy their own human experience, then you can believe in anything that you want to believe. That is why I'm not against antinatalists. I don't know if you've heard about the philosophy of antinatalism, David Benatar. Better to never have been born. The people who believe that it is morally sinful to bring a child into the world. You should read up on that particular stance. You see, that's the thing. That's Benatar's meaning to life. And a lot of critics have tried to criticize it, but you know, there's no
objective. I just Googled it and I think that's a very stupid view on life, because I mean, that defies evolution. The whole purpose of chimps or like the evolutionary cycle, that they're like their own ideology just kind of cancels what we are as humans.
Yeah, but then the thing is, why do you attach so much meaning to what we are as humans? Your perspective on your value as a human being is based on the fact that you are human and you feel superior over every other creature or being that exists on the surface of this planet, you believe that it is, was designed for you to reign and control and be a steward for this planet. But that is not an undisputable fact. That is not fact. That is what you believe. And that is what, because for all we know, this entire planet could be a random experiment or random thing that happened per chance by whatever creator. Yeah, I mean, for all we know, we haven't no singular basis for the human experience.
If it's a simulation, then we have to find meaning to it.
I mean, then when you say we have to find meaning to it, do you want to force or compel people who feel like this entire experience is a painful and unnecessary one? Do you want to subject them to existence because you feel like we have to collectively find meaning to our experience?
So, you know, most of when you look at hierarchies and, you know, in society or maybe nature, you now tend to see things like schools. That means we should abolish everything we have now, because why should a child go to school? Why should anybody want to, you know, learn to do something, you know, want to add this value to themselves so that they could jump higher than someone else in the hierarchy of life?
Well, I think for me, that's a personal question left answered by whomever it is that wants to go to school. Personally, if you ask me, I mean, if I was removed from human society as a whole, I wouldn't want to go to school. I wouldn't want the children that I raised to go to school. I probably, of course, want them to be knowledgeable and informed about so many world issues and so many factors that play several roles in the way that human lives are shaped. But I wouldn't want them to go to school because I feel like school is a structure that is just simply fundamentally designed to place people in jobs and find connections and, you know, the social obligatory parts of it. But school is not a guarantee that you would be a knowledgeable, wise, intellectual person. It's not a guarantee that you will have any source of meaning in your life. It is just, to me, fundamentally an obligatory passage of rights that humans have to go through as long as they are part of a societal structure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't want us to get stuck around in this cycle because, you know, there's so much we can talk about it. I have my own opposing views, but, you know, just to save time, okay, we could move forward to the recent issues around rape and rape culture concerning, you know, the ones we saw on Twitter. And what are your thoughts on, because I have my own reservations on, you know, these organizations that were set up to, that I think their own goal was to kind of protect rape victims, stand to end rape. What are your thoughts on them and maybe concerning the whole recent rape dilemma we've seen in the past few months?
Well, of course, I think rape has been something that has always been happening in our societies. And I think that right now it's just because of the fact that so much focus has been put to it because people are actually speaking out and people are actually heading movements to highlight these cases that have always been existing. So, and I think that this current wave of rape cases being brought to light can be both very, 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 very useful and very, very, very impactful and important to us in ending rape to some extent. But I think when it is being used perniciously, when it is being used in the wrong hands, it can also be very terrible. And me saying that is the fact that this particular call, I do believe that a lot of times it's hard to find evidence for rape. It's hard to find concrete proof that rape has happened in so many instances. And sometimes people say stupid things like, well, why didn't you go and report immediately when it happened? Or why didn't you scream for help when it was happening to her? Well, I don't think it is easy to make that statement if you have not been in a situation where you have been sexually assaulted or someone has tried to sexually assault you. There are people who just freeze and can't do nothing. It doesn't make any intellectual sense. It doesn't make any rational sense for you to say, why would you just freeze? Or why can't you just go out and tell people things? Of course, there's so many rational arguments that can come out of that. But the thing is, when you are there in that particular moment, experiencing rape happen to you or sexual assault of any form, it is hard to rationally, for a lot of people, not everyone, of course, there are people who rationally act on the circumstance, but it's hard for a vast majority of people to act on that circumstance. And a lot of time it stems from the power dynamics that goes into situations of rape, the vulnerability that it encapsulates. And I think that is something that a lot of people who talk about trying to save men from defamation don't think about. It is a very complex issue, and I don't think we're anywhere near finding a perfect solution to ensuring that some innocent people don't get falsely accused, and also to ensure that even victims who don't have proof can get the justice that they deserve. And that's why it leads a lot of people to asking, well, what is worse? Is it worse for a person to have their character defamed, or is it worse for a victim to not be believed and live her life entirely doubting her sanity and her relevance as a human being? And I think that's a question that collectively as a society, we need to sit down and have a discourse on, because I don't think it's something that we can just form personal opinions on which scale we want to tip lower or higher. Yeah. So I don't think I have a solution to that particular question. I don't think I've spent a ridiculous amount of time going over it, though. I wish I had enough time to think about it in that sense. But yeah,
I've thought about it. I've thought about it in the sense of like just the way murder can't stop people killing each other. Mm-hmm. So maybe that kind of crime would still continue. And in the sense of, you know, like to be alive is to suffer, and anything could happen at any time. Because I mean, it's not fair that a lion chases and eats a gazelle and, you know, kills them in that way.
Exactly. Why someone like nature. Benatar is saying, why do you have to force people to be born in the first place? If you are really painting this really grim, grim picture of the human experience. I mean, someone can say, oh, well, but there are beautiful things about life. I mean, you get to have family and experience love and pleasure and so many other things. But you really should read David Benatar, yeah? I mean, I have criticism of his points and his views, but I don't think everything he's saying is pure rubbish as opposed to so many other people. So.
I still think that there is a green light. I mean, there's like a bright line, you know, between this is good and evil. You know, we could still see the human experience as a beautiful thing, because there are so many things we choose to ignore, because bad things are rare. Oh, you know, really? Bad people are rare.
Well, it depends on your definition of bad, though. I mean, I think that's where the fundamental explanation of that whole statement is. I mean, take for example the lives of children who are born in Syria and other countries where they face war and hunger and starvation. And take, for example, the experiences of people who are born with deformities and people who are born with brain issues and people who are born with tremendous forms of natural, of situations where they didn't want to be born into, and they cannot do anything about the state in which they are born to suffer. I mean, take into account all of that. I think that's what colors the experience. You cannot know how someone is going to be born and experience life. You cannot know how, because of course it's easier now that there's so much genetic engineering involved in detecting if, in figuring out if a child can be born with serious disability. And some parents can choose not to, but then there are parents who choose to have the children anyway and bring them into the world to suffer. But yeah, that's a conversation for another day. But I'm just saying, like, there are other issues even outside the medical aspect of knowing. There are mental health issues that are less talked about because people don't understand how it affects people who have to live and deal with these particular issues of taking medication day in, day out to survive. I mean, a lot of the times when you ask people like that, would you choose to never have been born? I think the answer is not very far-fetched.
What I would say is that, I mean, I think it's it's kind of nihilist to paint the whole human experience in that light.
I mean,
I still feel like, because I've thought about it in the sense of thinking you brought up now. I've thought about it in that sense.
I'm not a nihilist.
I'm starting to see it.
Just putting out the disclaimer here that I am not a nihilist. I'm sorry, nihilist, but I don't think that the human experience is just, I'm just objectively talking about different point of views and why you cannot necessarily dismiss someone's point of view regarding particular issues. I don't want to, I don't have to 100% agree with someone to understand that they are factual or they are reasonable statements and reasonable points that they are making. And I think Benatar is one of such people. I mean, even if I do not 100% agree with everything he's saying, I do think that there are reasonable questions that he has raised. And I feel like we need to have reasonable conversations before we dismiss those things. And if we don't have reasonable answers to them, well, that's a conundrum that we need to address.
I think, like, because I've had this conversation with my friend about, you know, just the true human nature, what human nature is. And
I feel like we are fond of digressing a lot in these conversations that we have. I mean, we've moved from so much conversations regarding rape and feminism, and now we are jolly on philosophy.
Yeah, we are still coming there because we are still talking about rape because it's part of suffering. And I don't know if we should continue digressing on this philosophical part of what it means to suffer or why suffering is inescapable.
Well, suffering is escapable. I mean, just don't exist. I mean, that's realistic, but like that's a solution to not suffering though.
What are your thoughts on the Me Too movement? And because I want to address this victimhood culture that started, I think, with the Me Too movement that was hijacked by false accusers and, you know, people who just wanted to gain attention at that point to claim victim. It's like you wear a certain crown if you could attain victimhood status during those times. Even now, it's still happening. And I think it started majorly from the Me Too movement around sexual harassment and rape and all those things.
I feel like I'm faced with this question every single time that I go online to have a conversation with people. And I think that is one of the biggest criticism I have against the radical left. But then it's also a criticism I have for people who downplay what it means to be a victim of circumstances. I mean, people use this large terms of, well, everyone's a victim of circumstances if you look at it. So why is it that some people get to be given special privileges because you're victims of particular circumstances? Yeah. My problem is not in saying, well, these people who are victims of this particular injustice, like people who are marginalized, it's not in saying, well, these people need to always be put as priority, these people always need to be given special treatment. These people always need to be believed 100% whenever they say, and they need to be unquestionable because they are fragile. Now, the problem is my criticism is on the fragility of victimhood mentality. And maybe it is not the victimhood mentality. It's probably my criticism of the fragility of being a victim as used as a means to give them a sense of impunity against criticism and a sense of impunity against responsibility. Yeah, I do believe that people can be victims of more things than others. I do believe that for, say, example, a white person who lives in America and who comes from an upper middle class family, they have more privilege than someone who is a black person and comes from a lower middle class family. And I think that's a very blatant representation of privilege and what it means to be a victim of certain circumstances. And the problem with this particular example for me is the systemic representations of this injustice. It is that someone comes and meets me and tells me, well, there is no such thing as systemic racism in America. But then I look at them and I'm like, well, really, that's untrue. I mean, there's still so much identity politics being played in America. And I know a lot of people disagree with me on this particular issue, but I think it's one of these issues people don't really like outrightly have like enough points to agree or completely disagree with. Yeah. So, but I think that America is systemically built to sustain white people in power and to use them, their experience and your narrative as the standard for people to be treated fairly and to have access to opportunities and in society. Yeah? Yeah, and I think that's for me is why I always still find myself taking the side of Black people who are angry and who are oppressed. I don't necessarily agree with all their representation. Sorry, their, yeah, no, their, what word do I use? Their reflection of their anger, the way they demonstrate their anger. Yeah. I'm not necessarily 100% in line with that, but I do agree that there is a reason for them to be angry. There is a reason for them to question the systems, and there's a reason for everyone to have civil conversations regarding why particular things are the way that they are and how people can do better. I don't think it is okay for a Black person to look at a white person and say, you have to take responsibility for what your ancestors did in, like, years ago. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Of course, I would say white people should acknowledge their privilege in so many ways, and not white people, like, generally, because there are white people that fare poorly than some Black people in America. You get it. I feel like this statement is basically focused on people who are white and not just white, but white and economically privileged.
Yeah.
Exactly. They are the ones that need to use their privilege to do what is right. And that's just it. Because I wouldn't say a meth head in, let's say, a country in the southern part of America who's living in like a trailer park has more privilege than the Black person who is in the Oval Office. And of course that's not true. But socially and politically, it is true that white privileged people have more privilege than Black privileged people.
I still have this objection that we all have privilege in a certain way. And I should not just be walking around with, you know, some certain kind of mindset whereby this person has more privilege than me, then I should, you know, he has some kind of ethical responsibility to me. I still don't like that kind of worldview.
But I think they have an ethical responsibility, but I don't think we can force them to do it. That's the difference. I do think if you're someone who believes in ethics and believes in morality, then you, of course, you have an obligation to ensure that you use your privilege to help correct injustices that are happening around the world. I think it's a moral obligation for anyone who exists with privilege. I think it's a privilege for, sorry, it's a moral obligation for me as an able-bodied woman to ensure that I speak up for disabled people as much as I can, intentionally. Because I have the privilege of not being disabled. And there are disabled people who cannot access buildings because the buildings are not designed to accommodate them. Yeah? And I think that's my privilege. And I think it's my moral obligation to do as much as I can to ensure that disabled people are not left behind. So, and I think that's how it goes up the chain. You know, it's also a privilege for me to be basically, I mean, that's, but I don't want to say something that can be used against me somehow someday, but you know, I just think that it's a privilege that we all share in different levels. Of course, I wouldn't have the privilege of someone who is a child of a politician, a Nigerian politician, for example, who has the power to, who has some certain amounts of of wealth and affluence in their disposal to influence so many things. I wouldn't have that level of privilege that they have. But because I feel like they have a higher moral obligation than I do in so many aspects. They have a higher moral obligation to speak up against injustices and use their platform for, but of course it's not a forceful thing. But of course I will obviously criticize them for not using their platform to do their moral obligation. But I will not force them. There's no law that should compel anyone to uphold moral obligations. I just think that as a decent human being, you should use your privilege all the time to try and right injustices.
I think it just depends on our different moral compass, though, because I mean, some people just want to live. I know you're not one of the many fans of capitalism, and and you know, I know you would think that maybe the poor, like the rich, has a kind of obligation to the poor. But I still feel it just depends on our individual moral compass. Well, that could be like a social responsibility.
The thing is, you say individual moral compass. Can it be criticized, though? I can't criticize a rich person not wanting to redistribute wealth, and I can't criticize their amassing of wealth and their exploitation of the lower working class. But can you criticize my stance to not expect that it's a moral obligation for these people to actually be held morally accountable to their obligations of fighting injustices using their privileges? You know, that's my point, is that it's not about your personal stance on things. It's about objective criticism. If your beliefs cannot stand the test of objective criticism, then it's a problem. And I think that's how we should be looking at, like, I think that's how society as a whole should live on that sort of introspection regularly. I don't think there's any view in the world that is immune to criticism. I don't think just because trans people say they are women, that they are women, they have to explain, and people have to have conversations as regard how trans women are women. It's not just to say, oh, well, I wake up tomorrow and I say, well, I'm a trans man, and then people accept me for that because I say it. I feel like it should be always open to criticism. So this is why I don't believe in the cancel culture a lot of radical leftists use when someone gives an opinion that is different. For example, the J.K. Rowling situation, where she said something. I don't agree with what how J.K. Rowling said what she said. I think it's insensitive for someone who is an author and someone who is a progressive individual. But I think she has the right to ask questions. Yeah, I think she has the right to ask a question about, is a trans woman really a woman? And I think she has the right to bring her side of the argument. And I feel like we as a collective society have the right to listen to her. I shouldn't use the word right. We have the responsibility to listen to her and have a conversation that is civil regarding this particular topic. So that's my problem with a lot of people who just said, well, cancel her, she's a TERF, or cancel her, she hates trans people, you know?
Yeah, I'm not even a fan of the cancel culture at all and at any level. And what I do feel, because J.K. Rowling said something, and you know, this kind of thing inhibits free speech in the sense of we want people to be free, equal, you know, to say what they think, to express themselves freely. That's still part of the activism that people do. But we just cancel people for what they think.
Yeah.
I know there are a lot of gender critical feminists around this issue, but maybe that's another kind of conversation. Let's talk about your own life. I've seen your style. I mean, what was inspiring it? Because it's kind of unique in a way. I've seen it in maybe movies, but you know, I'm trying to still touch it in the sense of why she would embrace the style. What was the motivation? Would I say was the backing behind it?
Yeah. Regarding my fashion sense, I think my fashion sense, sorry, is informed by a lot of things. And I think it started from right when I was like a child, because it started from when my mom would be like, wear skirts. And I'd be like, oh, so I wear the skirts, and then I sit down the word and I want to sit down. And she's like, you can't sit down like that wearing skirts. You need to sit down a certain way. And I'm like, then why do I have to wear the skirts in the first place? So I hated skirts naturally because I felt that they were very restrictive and they made me behave a certain way that I didn't want to behave necessarily. So I hated skirts naturally from there. I mean, I liked climbing trees and I liked running and et cetera. So I felt like skirts was a hindrance to those kind of activities. And at the end of the day, if I was forced to wear a skirt, it had to be a long, very A-shaped skirt that allowed me the freedom to open my legs and, you know, do things the way that I did. That's what, probably when I go to church, that's the kind of skirts that I, and dresses that I only wore. So I always had an issue with bodycon clothing because I thought they were really restrictive. I think over time that has not changed. I like my clothing to be as comfortable and less restrictive as possible. And regarding that, my number one influence, my clothing to be less restrictive and as comfortable as possible, then the next is probably I feel like I'm drawn to artistry and experimentation regarding artistry. And I think for me, depending on whatever whatever phase in my sense of reception of art is, I think that's what informs whatever way that my clothing choices are informed outside comfort and freedom. So if it's a phase where I really am into colors, then I wear a lot of clothes that are colorful. If it's a phase where I'm really into structure, then I'm wearing a lot of toned colors like brown and beige and gray, but with a lot of more of frills and, you know, borders and lines. And that's just it. Sometimes it's just like that. I like to experiment with that. But the only thing that I always know is always static is my love for comfort and unrestricted clothing. That has never changed.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a lot to unpack, though. And what's your general philosophy towards life, you know, as a whole? How do you say you approach life right now?
I would say to live life in a constant state of introspection, fully open to change and criticism, and to also do as much good as I possibly can. I think for me, that's my ultimate current philosophy on life.
I like to ask my guests what they think is the meaning of life at the end, but I think that would be a really, really stupid question to ask now that.
Oh my God. I can understand.
So, what's just one thing you want everybody to hear? I mean, a lot of people listen to this podcast. What do you want to tell them?
I want to just tell them that always, always be open to criticism. Your current beliefs are not foolproof. Yeah, they're not the only way to do things and not the ultimate way to do things. I think you should always leave yourself open to change because it's a constant part of growth. And if you're not changing, well, it's an indicator that you're not necessarily growing, is it? Isn't it? I mean, I just...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I really love this conversation. I think I do hope you come back another time. You know, we'll address some other kind of issues.
I hope so too.
And it was nice having you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the end. If you enjoy this conversation, please share this episode, subscribe to this podcast, also leave a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, don't forget to contact me at Hinted Neuron on Instagram and Twitter. That's it for me this week, and until then, stay curious.